Good afternoon, everybody. I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:32 p.m. on Tuesday, February 21st. We're meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Committee members present today are Senator Giesel, Vice Chair Kaufman, Senator Tobin, and we have Senator Dunbar on Teams. And myself, Senator Wilson. We do have a quorum to conduct business today. First up, we are going to move Senate Bill 45, Direct Healthcare Agreement on Insurance, has been removed from the agenda. It was just better procedure and documents and a request to do a CS just for better conformity and then doing amendments and try to reform that piece of legislation. So we will try to bring a CS to the committee at our next scheduled meeting on Thursday. And that leaves us the two items left on our agenda. First, we'll return to Senate Bill 8, the Repeal of Certificate Need Program, which is sponsored by my office. We heard introduction on this bill on February 16th. Today, we will take questions from the committee members, from our invited testifiers, and take public testimony. And then we will continue on to Senate Bill 53. Offered by Senator Klayman's office. With that, we'll invite Mr. Zepp up to the committee. And we will continue on with a brief sexual analysis. And we'll put yourself on the record. You may begin when you're ready, Mr. Zepp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record. My name is Gary Zepp, staff to Senator David Wilson. I'll proceed with the Senate Bill Repeal Certificate of Need sectional analysis. Sections 1 through 3 fall under Title 12, the Code of Criminal Procedure, Chapter 25, Arrests and Citations. And this runs from page 1, line 4, through page 2, line 4. And it makes conforming amendments to statutes 18-2400 and 18-2499 to eliminate references to the Alaska Statute 1807-111, which is repealed under Sections 9 and 10 of the bill. Sections 4, 5, and 6 fall under Title 18, which is the Health, Safety, Housing, Human Rights, and Public Defender, Chapter 20, Hospitals and Nursing Facilities. Section 4, page 2, line 8, through page 4, line 10. This is a conforming amendment to Statutes 18-26-220 by removing references to repealed sections of law. Section 5, page 4, lines 11 through 23 is a conforming amendment to Statutes 18-2200-C-7-A-I, which defines a residential psychiatric treatment center licensed by the Department of Health. Section 6, page 4, line 24 through page 5, line 5, also makes conforming amendments to statutes 1820-499-2 to eliminate references to statute 1807-111, which is repealed under sections 9 and 10 of the bill. Section 7 falls under Title 18 as well, but it's a different chapter. It's Chapter 26, Alaska Medical Facility Authority, and this is page 5, lines 6 through 16, repeals a section of uncodified law, Section 4, Chapter 275, SLA 1976, which provided a transition to allow medical facilities in existence or under construction before July 1, 1976, to obtain a certificate of need. Section 8 also falls under Title 18, but a different chapter. It's Chapter 35, Public Accommodations and Facilities. This is on page 5, lines 17 through 29, and it makes conforming amendment that removes a reference to the Certificate of Need, Statute 1807-111, and replaces it with an updated statute reference under Statute 1820-400-D, for definitions. Section 9 also falls under Title 18, but a different chapter. It's Chapter 07, Certificate of Need. This is on page 5 through line 30 through page 6, line 1, and it repeals all of the statute under 1807, which describes the Certificate of Need program for healthcare facilities, and statutes 2186-030-C1, statute 4464-030-A18, and statute 4780-140-B, which also relate to the Certificate of Need program. Section 10 falls under the original law establishing CON, page 6, line 2, repeals section 4, chapter 275, SLA 1976 in its entirety. Section 11 is a Certificate of Need applicability. This is on page 6, line 3 through line 8. It amends uncodified law and provides that the Department of Health may not take action on or after the effective date of sections 1 through 11 to revoke, enforce, or modify a Certificate of Need issued to a healthcare facility before the effective date of sections 1 through 11 of this act. Section 12, page 6, lines 9 through line 14, amends uncodified law by adding a new subsection that directs the Department of Health to create necessary regulations by July 1st, 2025, to implement the changes made by this act by then, but not before the effective date of sections 1 through 11 of this act. Section 13, page 6, line 15, just states that section 12 of this act takes effect immediately, which points you back to the regulations under statutes 01-10-070-C. And lastly, section 14, page 6, line 16, states that except as provided in section 13 of this act takes effect July 1st, 2026. And Mr. Chairman and committee members, if I could just take a quick moment, sections 5, 11, and 12 unfortunately refer to the Department of Family and Community Services and not the Department of Health. This was an error that got past Ledge Legal and myself, and I apologize for that, but we'll have that cleaned up in the next version of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zepp. Are there any questions for the sponsor or for Ms. Kavanaugh or Dr. Mitchell from the previous hearing? Senator Dunbar, do you have any questions before we open up to public testimony? And don't forget to unmute yourself. All right. Seeing none, we'll go ahead and open to public testimony. First on the line, we have Dr. Jeffrey Singer from the Cato Institute, and then he'll be followed by Jared Kosten. If you can remind yourself, you have 2 minutes for a testimony. You may begin when you're ready, Dr. Singer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeffrey Singer. I'm a senior fellow in health policy studies at the Cato Institute, and I'm a general surgeon in private practice in Phoenix, Arizona for over 40 years. I've submitted written testimony, but I'll briefly summarize it here. Roughly four decades since repeal of the 1974 federal law that incentivized states to establish the Certificate of Need laws, or CON laws. CON laws still exist to varying degrees in 35 states. Lawmakers enacted CON laws based on a theory that restricting the supply of health care services would somehow reduce demand for those services and thus restrain health care spending. However, policymakers should have noticed that third-party payers, private or government-run, pay for most healthcare services. This insulates most patients from the actual prices of healthcare services, while third-party payers absorb the costs. Consumer patients with little skin in the game have no incentive to be cost-affected. When price signals are inoperative, demand continues despite restrictions in supply, and shortages inevitably ensue while prices paid by third-party payers increase at a greater rate than would have otherwise occurred. This is basic economics. The only way to reduce healthcare expenditures when healthcare consumers are largely insulated from price effects is to decrease availability and access to healthcare. In a George Mason University Mercatus Center working paper, a review of 20 academic studies found that CON laws largely failed to achieve their goal of reducing healthcare costs and concluded that the overwhelming evidence is that con laws lead to higher per unit costs and higher expenditures. Con laws render state healthcare systems sclerotic and unable to rapidly adjust their infrastructure to meet the changing demands of public health emergencies. Despite their ineffectiveness, many states still have a variety of these laws on the books today. By 1990, however, Arizona, California, Colorado, Idaho, Kansas, Minnesota, New Mexico, South Dakota, Texas, Utah, Wisconsin, and Wyoming repealed their con laws. Our hospital administrators argue that con laws allow them to generate enough revenue to provide 24-hour emergency services and uncompensated care, but physicians and other healthcare practitioners also provide uncompensated care and other services, yet state professional organizations don't argue for creating a certificate of need requirement before allowing additional doctors, nurses, psychotherapists, physical therapists, et cetera, to set up practices in the state. And they would publicly be derided if they did so. New healthcare practitioners entering the state may provide competition to incumbents, but this has not stunted the growth of healthcare professions. Instead, it has benefited health.
Dr. Singer, can you wrap up your testimony? Your time's up.
Hello?
Yeah, if you could wrap up your testimony, your 2 minutes.
Oh, okay. I just heard something from the. Okay. Alaska lawmakers should heed the lessons provided by the public health crisis and act now to repeal con laws and rid their healthcare system of discredited central planning reminiscent of a bygone era. Thank you for allowing me to share my perspective with this committee.
Thank you, sir. Next up is Jared Cosin, and then we'll go to the Delta Junction folks. Bill Ward, you'll be after Jared. If you could place your...
Mr. Chair, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jared Cosin. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. On behalf of our hospitals, nursing homes, and other healthcare partners, many of whom you saw in the Capitol last week, we respectfully oppose Senate Bill 8. Addressing CON is not a binary choice. It's not either we repeal or not repeal. And to analyze it that way grossly oversimplifies the issue. Healthcare is complex, and the wholesale removal of CON directly threatens access to care for our vulnerable population. Also, overall transparency in healthcare costs. This is why a vast majority of the states in our country do have certificate of need laws. We all agree healthcare costs are too high, but healthcare is not a free market and it will not respond that way. Why? Because the prices for over 50% of our healthcare services rendered are set and paid for by the government. When we eliminate CON, we're simply paving the way for a proliferation of ambulatory services that only serve patients with private insurance. We've seen this happen in Georgia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and other states. While this may be convenient for those with private insurance, it jeopardizes access to services for our Medicaid and Medicare population. It also completely undermines the ability to deliver core services in community hospitals. There's a reason why CON repeal leads to a proliferation of surgery centers and imaging centers. These are the profitable service lines. These are what keep labor and delivery, emergency rooms, inpatient rehab and dialysis possible. Would we be better off with more surgery centers and imaging centers, but a hospital where you cannot have a baby or go to an ER? Of course not. Like any policy issue, balance is what we need to strike. And we agree with the sponsor that the program is flawed, but it hasn't been updated in 20 years. All the details for Alaska's CON program are in the administrative code in the regulations. And if we're going to modernize the program and fix it, that is where it has to be done. So in closing, it is for these reasons we ask the legislature not to advance Senate Bill 8, but rather direct the Department of Health to work with Alaskan stakeholders on refinements to the administrative code. We respectfully ask the committee to vote no on Senate Bill 8. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next, we'll go to Bill Ward in Delta Junction. Bill, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much.
Place your name on the
My name is Bill Ward. I live in Delta Junction. I'm affiliated with the Interior Hospital Association and also speaking as an aging senior in the state. I speak to legislation to repeal the certificate of need has been around the legislature since 2018, and I have been actively involved in each bill that has died in each session, not because of the lack of support, but rather the legislature's irresponsible method of delaying everything to the end of a session for a budget battle and ignoring actions on important bills. Delta Junction is at the epicenter of the need for advanced medical care and the restrictions caused by the con exacerbate that situation. We do have two clinics that provide good urgent care and routine care. Emergency care, advanced diagnostics, and extended care has been handled by the Fairbanks hospitals. The need to expand medical care in Delta is recognized, and the local clinics are making the effort, but they run into the wall of a con, and they can't expand to meet the growing community medical needs. Delta Junction is an island in the middle of Alaska, and the barriers to our accessing proper health care are getting worse. Right now, if a patient enters a clinic and their condition isn't stabilized by the end of the day, the clinic has no choice other than to put them in an ambulance and send them to Fairbanks. There is no option of monitoring a patient overnight under nurse's care until they stabilize or get better. The clinics don't have, nor can they get, because of the con restrictions, the sophisticated equipment needed to make a proper diagnosis, leading to too many patients having to be shipped off in an ambulance to Fairbanks. And back to the island reference. The 100-mile highway to Fairbanks is wearing out, overcrowded, and soon to be taken over by a huge overhaul operation and military traffic. Ambulance traffic will be restricted, and individual people will have more and more trouble making medical trips to Fairbanks on their own. Our ambulance service is operating at a loss right now, and we're desperately trying to figure out how to stabilize that critical service. Weather events that could prevent access to Fairbanks by road and air. We are an island.
Hey, Bill?
Delta Junction is growing. Our citizens...
Thank you. Hey, Bill, if you could wrap up, your time is up.
Just one more line. Our citizens are aging, and our need for critical health care is expanding. The existing laws governing CON restrict and prevent the people of Delta Junction and all of Eastern Alaska from receiving proper health care. Please advance Senate Bill 8 this session, and I respectfully repeat, this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Next up is Mary Baker Kaspari, followed by Don Fraser.
What happened? Okay, you touched that.
Mary, are you with us? All right, we'll come back to you, Mary. We'll go to Don Fraser. All right. We'll come back to Delta Junction. We'll continue on to Steve Franks in Fairbanks, followed by Pat Shire.
Okay, thank you. My name is Steve Frank. I'm on the board of Foundation Health Partners in Fairbanks. We have a hospital, a clinic, and a long-term healthcare facility. We support the CON to stay in existence, so that means we oppose Senate Bill 8. We're a locally owned nonprofit, and we are operating lots of things that don't make money, and a few lines that do. Surgery and imaging are two that do make money. And those are the kinds of things that somebody would come in and suck away the business from. And the thing that I want the committee to understand is that if you pass this, we could be hurt. And our Medicaid costs could go up. Your budget could go up because it probably will go up because if business gets sucked away from us, you're going to have to give us a higher Medicaid rate to keep the only hospital north of the range in business. And that's something you should consider. It's a complicated issue, and it's certainly too complicated to talk about in 2 minutes of testimony. I don't know why you guys are limiting it to 2 minutes after all these years. It deserves more, you know, more than 2 minutes, to be honest. And anyway, be careful about doing it because I don't think it's going to reduce costs. I think it's going to increase your Medicaid budget. That's my main point. Happy to answer questions if you have them.
Thank you, Steve. And for those also listening online, if you want to provide more comment, feel free to email the Senate HES Committee at shss@akleg.gov, and we can put that your comments on the record. Next is Pat Shire, and then we'll try to go back to the folks in Delta Junction. Pat, if you can.
Chair Wilson, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Patrick Shire. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 8, and indeed in favor of measures generally that seek to enlist what we know is the immense power of freer competitive markets in pursuit of better health care access and pricing. I serve as the Alaska membership representative for the Pacific Health Coalition, a private nonprofit coalition of 49 self-funded health plans across Alaska and the Pacific Northwest. We assist these plans and their 240,000 members in finding ways to provide the best price and value in quality health care. Leveraging available competitive principles, member plans saved over $721 million in 2021, an increase over $100 million of the prior year. Competition is responsible for historic discounts in many areas, including orthopedic surgery in South Central Alaska, spurred on in part by the realization many of our members were using medical tourism, saving their plans several million dollars a year. Forward-looking orthopedic provider approached us and said, we're ready to negotiate. That allowed us to cut drastically professional fees charged for those high-quality services. It's not to say government intervention is never warranted, but the CON has outlived its usefulness and now creates barriers to entry in an industry that is of critical value to Alaska. We recommend the repeal of the certificate of need, but one necessary step as we examine together how we can further unravel the many distortions present in the healthcare industry, helping providers, payers, and consumers to think afresh about high quality, effective healthcare delivery in Alaska. I recommend advancing Senate Bill 8. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. Next, we'll go back to the folks in Delta Junction. Mary Baker, are you with us?
Yes, I am. My name is Mary Baker Kaspari. I live in Delta Junction for 22 years, and my affiliation is with the Interior Alaska Hospital Foundation, and this is regarding Senate Bill 8. The Certificate of Need program was mandated by the federal government in 1974, and the program was developed to help defer health costs, improve access to health care, and to develop health care services to underserved areas. In 1987, the mandate was repealed by the federal government, but the states individually have chosen to take on some form of the Certificate of Need program. Delta Junction is one of the underserved health care areas of Alaska, and it is on the road system. Envision the map of Alaska. If you put your finger on Fairbanks and then on the Canadian border, there is no advanced health care available in the vast service area, only day clinics that work diligently at providing care to the highest degree of their ability. Our community is 100 miles to the nearest hospital, and depending on the day, the season, the weather, military convoys, trucking services, and whatever else could go wrong will dictate whether the ambulance or your private vehicle will or can get you to the hospital in ample time for treatment. It is sad to say that this problem is not realized until you or your loved one is involved in a life-threatening situation requiring immediate treatment, and time is of essence. In the world of medicine, there is a phrase called the golden hour. The translation of this is having the ability to get care within the first hour of injury to ensure the greater chance of survival. By removing the CON, this will enable us to increase our availability to necessary medical services in our community and our vast surrounding service area. Please advance SB 8 and repeal the Certificate of Need. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mary. Next up, we have Don Fraser.
Hello, my name is Don Fraser. I live in Delta Junction. I've lived here for 41 years. As you know, we're 100 miles south of Fairbanks. Beyond us is Choke, Northway, Eagle, Chicken, Paxton, Summit Lake, Black Rapids. None of those places have hospital facilities. They all have to drive through Delta to get to Fairbanks to get a higher level of health care. We all have to travel that long distance on questionable roads to get a higher level of care to sometimes save our lives. Our community has a cadre of hardworking volunteers who have come together to work on improving our community level of care. We've been and will continue to work hard to improve this. We have established a federally qualified health care clinic here in Delta and a pharmacy, first in our community. Now we're trying to get ourselves a small community hospital like Valdez, Nome, Wrangell, Cordova. It's a big task, and you would surmise that the state would be proud of strong-minded Alaskans working hard to improve their own communities, but that is not so. I've read some of the research. I've done some of the homework. It is proven and documented that this Certificate of Need program does not increase healthcare quality. Quite the opposite, in fact. The Certificate of Need is, in fact, connected to higher increase in healthcare costs. So, as I understand it, other large healthcare corporations, foundations, organizations get to weigh in on the decision for Delta Junction. And so we rural Alaskans, we must not only pay those higher costs and fees that they charge, but we also must pay for the added travel of flying or driving, out-of-town expenses of staying in a hotel and meals in order to pay their fees and get health care at that level. And if we can't, then we suffer the consequences, which sometimes can mean that some of us die. The Certificate of Need process is cumbersome, unfair, influenced by profit, and expensive. Isn't it time to do away with this program? Please do away with, please support Senate Bill number 8. And the one thing that comes to mind is, do you remember during the height of the pandemic in Alaska? Do you remember when so many people were very sick and in need of hospital beds? Do you remember what the hospital said? We don't have enough beds. Why? So very sick people were in cots in civic centers and community centers, being treated in ways that I suspect were not as good as being in the hospital. Some of those folks died, sadly. Why weren't they in the hospital? Because they didn't have enough beds. Who chose how many beds they have? They did, according to the...
Hey, Don, your time is up. Can you wrap up your testimony, please?
Please don't let this happen. Please pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good job.
And next, we have... we'll go to Eric Cordero from Alaska Policy Forum. Eric, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and plan 2 minutes for your testimony.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Cordero, Vice President of Operations at Alaska Policy Forum. Alaska's Certificate of Need requirements for healthcare providers are detrimental to the lives of Alaskans. They make it difficult and expensive to open new healthcare facilities and aggravate the challenges of access and affordability in our state. Patients are left with higher costs, lower quality care, and fewer options. These laws require businesses to prove their services are necessary before they can enter the market, which limits accessibility and innovation. This approach hinders the healthcare system's ability to adapt to emerging healthcare needs quickly. Furthermore, allowing existing providers to give input on their potential competition is not in the best interest of patients. The COVID-19 pandemic prompted Alaska and other states to temporarily suspend some of these requirements to ensure that essential healthcare services were delivered. The measure was necessary to provide much-needed healthcare services during the crisis and did not cause any problems. Why should that change now that the pandemic is over? Repealing the Certificate of Need laws will make the healthcare system more responsive to emerging needs for Alaskans. It is time for Alaska to follow the lead of other states that have already removed these requirements. Thank you for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Next, we have Antonio Leonard.
Yes, through the chair, this is Antonio Leonard. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
You can?
Yes, we can. Please proceed with your testimony.
Okay. I'm sorry. And then I didn't hear you. So, yes, I am in absolute support of SB number 8, and I am really grateful that you have brought this bill forward. I'm from your district, Mr. Chairman, and I'm going to keep my comments very brief, and that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling in. Next, we'll go to our folks to finish up their sort of invited testimony. We have Ms. Kavanaugh, was cut off last time because of our time limits. Ms. Kavanaugh, do you have any other testimony that you'd like to provide to our committee?
Thank you, Chairman Wilson. Yeah, members of the committee, this is Jamie Kavanaugh. Again, I'm an attorney with the Institute for Justice. Just quickly, I'd like to start by reiterating that some policy points from the study I put together in 2020. From a policy perspective, several states with certificate of need laws purposely exclude rural areas from their certificate of need programs. Those states are Alabama, Oregon, Tennessee, and Washington. And Florida did the same thing before it repealed the bulk of its CON laws in 2019. So these states are excluding rural areas from their CON programs to encourage hospitals and other healthcare facilities to expand into these areas. Two other states, Utah and Colorado, haven't had a single rural hospital closure since at least 2005, and neither of these states have CON laws. So it can't be that CON is what's preventing rural hospital closures. Second, I just wanted to point out some of the support from the FTC and DOJ and federal government in support of repealing CON. And someone else mentioned that the federal mandate for certificate of need laws was repealed in 1987. At that time, when Congress was debating repealing the CON laws, they did so in part because they found that CON laws failed to control healthcare costs and were insensitive to community needs. And since that time, various agencies of the federal government have continued to be consistent in supporting CON repeal. In 2019, the FTC and the Antitrust Division of DOJ submitted testimony in support of the CON repeal bill in Alaska that was pending at that time. And they wrote that CON proponents concede that CON laws allow incumbent providers to earn greater profits than they would in a competitive environment. They argue that, in theory, these providers use profits to cross-subsidize charity care. But the evidence does not show that CON laws advance that goal. And there is some empirical evidence contradicting the notion that dominant providers use their market power to cross-subsidize charity care. So this was the DOJ and FTC reviewing the empirical evidence, the peer-reviewed journal articles on this topic, and found that certificate of need laws do not increase the amount of cross-subsidized charity care. But the articles do show that CON laws lead to higher costs, lower quality, and decreased access to care. So again, I'd urge your support for SB 8.
Thank you. Well, we have Mr. Zach Young from Anchorage.
Hello, this is Zach Young. I am testifying in support of SB 8 to repeal the certificate of need laws. I believe that these are antiquated laws with a goal of providing cheaper and more affordable health care to different communities. Unfortunately, because of their nature, they have done quite the contrary. It's obvious that Alaska has severe needs when it comes to medical care, and there are very many rural communities. And rural isn't a fair description of them either, because they're also isolated. There are many communities throughout Alaska that are not available to the road system and have no access to it. And this certificate of need doctrine has caused an undue hardship on these communities that should have hospitals for themselves or hospitals located more closely to them. But because of the certificate of need doctrine and extra requirements, hospitals that should have been built and would have been built were not built. So it is my belief that the repealing of this certificate of need doctrine will not only allow for cheaper and more affordable health care, but it will allow for competition within the hospital system to create a more efficient and affordable healthcare providing for the entire state of Alaska. So that is the reason that I will be supporting SB 8, and I believe that all the entire legislature and Senate should do that. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think that's everyone online. Is there anyone in the room that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 8? All right, seeing none, we will go ahead and close public testimony. And I just want to make sure, Dr. Mitchell, I'm not sure if we cut you off last week either for invited testimony. Did you have any last comments you wanted to add under invited testimony?
Thank you so much. The only thing I suppose I might add, just in response to a couple of comments today, there was a question about healthcare is not a free market, and that's certainly true. But you there's lots of interventions in healthcare that you certainly don't need a free market for more competition to make things better. It was mentioned that Medicaid spending is likely to go up in the event that CON is repealed. Well, we don't have to speculate about that. We can, again, turn to the data. This is among one of the many things that's been studied. You can look at a paper by Nancy Miller, Charlene Harrington, and Elizabeth Goldstein, Access to Community-Based Long-Term Care. Medicaid's role was published in 2002 in the Journal of Aging and Health. They find that CON is associated with higher per capita Medicaid community based care expenditures. I should note that there's two other studies that find no effect of CON on Medicaid spending. At the very least, it's not going to harm anything. There are no studies, exactly zero studies among 40, that find that CON is associated with reduced spending on Medicaid. It's really hard to imagine that's going to work out that way, especially when we have so much data and so much theory to suggest that indeed, supply restriction tends to restrict supply and raise costs. So, the main thing I would just want to emphasize is we don't have to speculate. 3 out of 10 or 4 out of 10 Americans, depending on how you measure it, live in a state without CON, and we know from about 100 studies that their experiences are that they have greater access to higher quality and lower cost care.
All right. Thank you, sir. With that, are there any final questions from committee members on Senate Bill 8? Senator Dunbar? All right. No questions? All right. Thank you, sir. At this time, we'll put this bill aside, and we'll set an amendment deadline to have your amendments into Ledge Legal by close of business on Monday, February 27th. Notify our office that you plan to have amendments so we can further bring this bill back up for further consideration. Obviously, we heard about the drafting error that we'll try to fix as well, which brings our next, we'll take an at ease so we can get our next presentation up and ready for Senate Bill 53. We are back on the record. We have Senate Bill 53 before us. And this is a act relating to a voluntary commitment by Senator Klayman and staff from his office. Also, for those that may be in the audience, if you have not signed up for public testimony already, please make sure you do sign up so we can make sure we get you on in queue. Senator Klayman, you are ready to proceed. Just place yourself on the record. You may begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, this is Matt Klayman. I'm the state senator for Senate District H in West Anchorage. Our office began working on Senate Bill 53 at the request of other legislators in response to the tragic experience of a constituent in our district. Angela Harris is here today sitting next to me to share her story with the committee at the conclusion of our presentation and our sectional analysis. Angela is returning books to the Lusac Library in Anchorage when a man stabbed her in the back. The perpetrator had attacked two other women less than 2 months earlier and was released by the court after he was found incompetent to stand trial. We believe this individual should not have been released to the community. A petition for involuntary commitment should have been filed based on his prior attacks and his psychiatric condition that made him a danger to the community. In working on this legislation, we reviewed the extensive legal history of John Hinckley. You may remember that John Hinckley was arrested in 1981 for his attempted assassination on President Reagan. Hinckley was charged with attempted assassination, assault on a federal officer of the United States, and illegal use of a firearm. The jury found Hinckley not guilty by reason of insanity. Immediately upon this finding by the jury, Hinckley was committed to St. Elizabeth's Hospital for an indeterminate period of time, an involuntary commitment. From 1981 to 2022, the restrictions imposed on Hinckley by the court were lessened as his psychiatric condition improved. During his hold, Hinckley repeatedly petitioned the court for release from psychiatric hold. For example, in 1999, Hinckley filed a motion for conditional release. The court was required to make findings and fact and conclusions of law whether the proposed release would benefit the patient and be safe for the public. The court denied the motion because of Hinckley's history of deception, the hospital's repeated inability to control his actions, and an incident where Hinckley had attempted to stalk a member of the staff. Hinckley's counsel appealed the decision, and the appellate court affirmed the ruling of the lower court. In 2008, Hinckley was approved by the court for limited release for overnight stays at his mother's home. The plan included very detailed requirements for the plan of his stay, who was meant to supervise Hinckley, and how many times he was meant to meet with the local psychiatrist during his home stays. In 2013, Hinckley was approved for 8 17-day visits, with the purpose of these visits being genuine integration into the community. The court found that Hinckley's narcissistic personality disorder was not evidence of potential dangerousness, but maintained concerns about his failure to integrate himself into the community. In 2016, the hospital and the government agreed that Hinckley's primary diagnoses had been in full and sustained remission for well over 20 years, and most experts agreed that he'd received the maximum benefits possible for inpatient treatment. The court approved full convalescent leave with additional and modified conditions, and ultimately in 2021, the court held a status conference at which the government's counsel and Mr. Hinckley's counsel discussed his mental stability, compliance with conditions by the court, and their specific agreement as to Mr. Hinckley's unconditional release in 2022. Now, you might ask, why are we talking about John Hinckley? And the answer is that Hinckley was a person with mental illness who spent many years in involuntary commitment and who was only released after he was found to no longer present a danger to the community. And it's an illustration that the process actually takes time for people who have a demonstrated history of dangerousness. Senate Bill 53 deals with Title 12, which is related to criminal charges, and Title 47, which is related to civil proceedings. The determination if an individual is competent or incompetent to stand trial, in addition to the restoration to competency, if deemed incompetent, is a process set out in the Code of Criminal Procedure, Title 12. The standard for determining an individual's competency to stand trial is found both in statute and in a long history of case law. A simplified explanation of competency is to think of, and it's an important consideration for the court, is whether the individual understands the charges against them, can assist their lawyer, and is therefore able to plead guilty or plead not guilty to the charges presented. Competency is not a defense to any charge and is unrelated to the mental state of the individual at the time of the crime. In order to protect constitutional due process rights of individuals in our legal system, a person who is incompetent to stand trial cannot be convicted of a crime. This is because a person has the right to understand the crime with which they are charged and as a result of that, the consequences of the crime they're charged with. A separate process is used for involuntary commitment, and that's in Title 47, the title for welfare, social services, and institutions. The standard for involuntary commitment is whether an individual, as a result of their mental illness, is a danger to themselves or others. Senate Bill 53 makes changes to existing law by creating a duty for the Department of Law to file a petition seeking involuntary commitment when an individual is found incompetent to stand trial at the expiration of a period of time for restoration to competency. The defendant is charged with a felony offense against the person, and the person presents a danger to themselves or others. The legislation does not specify which side of the Department of Law would file the petition, either criminal or civil division, and this is meant to allow the Attorney General's office flexibility in managing who makes the actual petitions. In our conversations with Angela, we grew to understand the direct impact the current statute has had on her ability to find the assurance she needs moving forward. The legislation before you creates a 5-year involuntary hold option for the state to proceed against individuals who meet the very specific criteria. First, they have been found incompetent to stand trial on a felony offense against the person. Second, they have been previously subject to involuntary commitment holds for 30, 90, and 180 days. Third, they have a history of a felony offenses against the person. And fourth, they present a danger to themselves or others. This expansion of Alaskans' involuntary commitment statutes reflects the reality that there exists a small number of individuals who, as a result of behavioral health issues, present a danger and are not suitable for community-based psychiatric treatment options. As a matter of protecting the due process right of individuals in the state of Alaska's care, Senate Bill 53 includes language that the respondent, the person who is in involuntary commitment, may petition for early discharge. The court must find, in order to approve an early discharge, that they no longer present a risk to themselves or others, such that they would be safe in the community. With that, my staff, Emma Potter, will now present a sectional analysis of the bill.
Good afternoon. For the record, this is Emma Potter, and I am staff to Senator Klayman. Section 1 adds a new subsection F to AS 1247-110, clarifying that the Department of Law has a duty to file an involuntary commitment petition when a person has been found incompetent to stand trial and the criminal charges are being dismissed due to the defendant's inability to be restored to competency. Section 2 adds a new section to AS 4730771, creating a 5-year involuntary commitment. 5-year commitment petitions are filed at the expiration of 180-day commitments for individuals who meet the following criteria. The respondent is mentally ill and as a result is likely to cause harm to self or others. The respondent has a history of repeated felony offenses against a person under AS 1141 or attempts of harm to self. The respondent has been found incompetent to stand trial under AS 1247-100 and 1247-110 for a felony offense against a person under AS 1141. And the finding that commitment of the respondent for greater than 180 days, but not greater than 5 years, is necessary to protect the public. Section 2 clarifies that findings of fact relating to the respondent's behavior made at the 30, 90, and 180-day commitment hearings shall be admitted as evidence and may not be rebutted, except that newly discovered evidence may be used for the purpose of rebutting the findings. Section 2 instructs the department to submit an annual report detailing how many individuals are held on 5-year commitments and how much time remains on each order of commitment. The report is to be submitted to the Attorney General, Public Defender, Public Advocate, the Alaska Court System, and the respondent's attorney. Section 3 amends subsection A of AS 4730780 to include reference to the new subsection C of AS 4730780. And Section 4 adds new subsections to AS 4730780, which require that the professional person in charge may not discharge respondents from involuntary commitment unless the court enters an order officially terminating the involuntary commitment after the hearing. This section requires a court decision on discharge of a respondent from involuntary commitment. And finally, Section 5 amends Section A of AS 4730805 to include 5-year commitments and states that a 5-year commitment period expires at the end of 5 years after the 180-day period of treatment. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? Also online, we have Dr. Christy Becker, the Chief Clinical Officer from our Alaska Psychiatric Institute. We have Stephen Bookman, the Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Law, and Steve Williams, the CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Senator Diesel.
Sure. Just a simple question through the chair, Senator Klayman. Why did you choose 5 years?
I was trying to seek a balance between a period of commitment that would kind of immediately lead you one to think you were taking away too many rights. So say, for example, a 50-year commitment seems like way too long in terms of giving somebody an option. You know, just seemed too long as a matter of just a rough sense of due process and what a court would approve. 5 years has some equivalencies to certain felony sentences of 5 years, and so the general thinking was that 5 years gives a longer period of commitment so that for purposes of planning, I think there's two sides. So one is a person such as Angela's place, does every 6 months does she need to wonder what's going to happen in the next hearing, which I think is putting a really very undue burden on a person in a person such as Angela's position. But I also think in terms of providing treatment to a person in psychiatric care, that if every 6 months there's going to be another hearing, I think a hospital is much more likely to think, well, we're going to the next six-month hearing. And if you're actually looking at trying to work towards the community integration, which is what was going on in the Hinckley case, that the five-year hold makes it more likely they'll start thinking about not what are we doing 6 months, but if you're on a 1-2-3-year plan, the odds of a successful community integration and a safe community integration is actually greater because the hold is longer. And at some level, you just have to pick a length of time that strikes that balance between not holding somebody without review for too long, but long enough to provide both some sense of security for a person like Angela in a victim's posture, but as well kind of from the treatment approach, because we're generally looking, in my perspective, at people who have very serious psychiatric issues. I think it's a very small number in Alaska, but I still think it's those that are suffering have very serious disabilities.
Thank you. That was a similar question that I had. Senator Coffin.
Senator Dunbar was ahead of me.
Oh, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Wonderful. I have two questions, one very specific and then one more general. The specific question, Senator Klayman, on page 2, starting at line 12, subsections 2 and 3, regarding the history of repeated felony offenses, and then 3, you know, found incompetent to stand trial under AS 12.47.100. I'm sort of curious. I'm trying to understand how that would work in practice. And what do you mean by the word repeated? So for example, if they'd committed one previous felony offense and been found incompetent, and then the second time they commit another offense, this procedure can be used. Is that correct? Is that what you mean by repeated, like on the second offense? Or would they have had to have at least two prior offenses before this could be sort of initiated?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, the question you raise is a good one. Our Court of Appeals has actually addressed, because there's other statutes that make reference to repeated instances of conduct, and I believe the Court of Appeals has interpreted that to mean more than one. I will say that in our working on the bill, we're leaning towards taking out the requirement of the repeated offense, that one prior felony offense against the person should be adequate, and so that the incident of that question would be the second one. So the first incident is not enough. You have to have a prior incident, but that becomes instance number one, and then the second instance would be the reason to go forward.
Senator Senator Dunbar?
Just a comment and then a follow-up. I think I lean towards your predilection there. I mean, the way it's – or your thinking there, the way it's written now, I think, so you couldn't use this procedure the first time they were found incompetent. You couldn't use it the second time they were found incompetent. You'd have to wait until the third felony-level offense against the person to use this. That's pretty significant. Am I misunderstanding?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I think that as I understand the Court of Appeals opinions, the second offense would be, or the second incident, because there was not a conviction on the first one, but the second incident would be a basis upon going forward. But because of that confusion that's consistent with what you articulate, that's the reason why my leaning is to take out the reference to repeat it.
Okay. Yeah, I think that would probably add clarity. And then my broader question, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Senator Klayman, how is this handled in other states? I mean, certainly we're not unique in having these kind of challenges with people that can't stand trial. So how has it been done elsewhere?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, there's two different features. One of the topics is how long do we hold people in a competency hold, somebody that is incompetent, and how long do you hold them to try to restore them to competency? And then the second question is how long do you authorize folks to hold folks that have been found incompetent and now you're proceeding under a civil commitment, and what's the length of time? My understanding is that what this bill seeks to do would be one of the early states that would provide, under very, very limited circumstances, the ability to have a longer involuntary commitment on the civil side based on the facts related to the criminal conduct that couldn't be prosecuted. So I'm not familiar with other states that have proposed this. We are familiar with other states on the hold for incompetency. I believe I learned recently that Colorado will allow them to hold somebody to try to restore them to competency for the length of the actual potential sentence on the criminal charge. So if somebody were facing, say, a 99-year sentence, they could be held involuntarily trying to restore to competency for up to 99 years. I tend to think that would run afoul of due process concerns somewhere after year one. And before you're 99, I don't mean to make light of it, but that seems like you're basically putting somebody in jail without ever having brought them to trial. So, and the topic about whether we should look at making some modifications to the period one can hold somebody to restore to competency is actually another topic that we've been hearing about as we've worked on this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman, and Senator Tobin.
Thank you. My question is really at the same point, starting at line 10 on page 2, and this is for the bill sponsor. I just want to be sure, like in just plain language as we read these conditions, would there be an and or an or after these? Are they inclusive? So do all of those requirements have to stack so as to be inclusive?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, if you look on line 18 in the sequence, it does have the word and. So requirements 1, 2, 3, and 4 of subsection B in the proposed statute are all, they're joined by and, so they all have to be true.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Klayman. I have a question that might sound really silly because I don't know. It is on page 2. Here on line 17, so an individual has been found incompetent to stand trial. When they are brought to competency, do they then go stand trial for their crime?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, that's actually a very good question. And there's different parts to the answer. The first is that what happens is there comes a time if after a period of hold to restore to competency, they are not restored to competency. That fact is brought forward in a court proceeding, and the court would dismiss the charges based on the fact they're incompetent. So that's That's scenario number one. Scenario number two is during the course of the competency hold. So initially they're incompetent, and then during the competency hold, they are deemed competent. Then at that point, the charges proceed because now they're competent to understand the charges against them. And then the third scenario is that even though the charges are dismissed by the court because of incompetency, my understanding is that the protections against double jeopardy do not apply where there was an incompetency finding. So if, say, just for an example, 1 year later the charges are dismissed based on incompetency, a year later the person is found to be competent, then the state could then refile the old charges and proceed to trial against them on the charges that were dismissed based on incompetency.
And just on that question, Senator Tobin, I'm sorry, Senator Tobin, is that spelled out in this bill? I didn't see that sort of that. Normally, lower charges, misdemeanors, and other things, they have time, statutes, and limitations. And I didn't know if that was spelled out here for things such as, you know, sexual abuse of a minor or death or, you know, murder charges, that there are no statute of limitations. Is that specified in this piece of legislation, or does that need to be clarified within this piece of legislation?
To the chair, the statutes of limitation that apply to certain crimes would not need to be specified in this legislation because those statutes of limitations already exist, and this wouldn't change those. And you might want to get a second opinion from the criminal division, but I would encourage you to get a second opinion, but my general thought is that in addition, like on a misdemeanor charge that might have a statute of limitations, that the incompetency hold probably would not toll the statute of limitations, but the clock would still run on the statute of limitations. And of course on murder charges and sexual assault and sex abuse, there's no statute of limitations, so that really doesn't come into play.
I guess my question was more on after they're found to be competent, and let's say they go in for the civil hold, does that need to be spelled out that they still can be charged for the original underlying charge?
I would want to defer to what Mr. Skidmore or others from the criminal division would say, but my general understanding is that it would not prevent them from filing charges. And I don't know if he's online today.
They are not. Yeah. But Ms. Mead is, and I'm not sure if she's prepared to answer that question, but she says she's yes, she is, so that's okay.
That's fine.
Musical chairs, and she gets to pick.
Thank you. This is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I think that is spelled out currently in the statute regarding findings of incompetency in 1247.110b. It clarifies what happens when somebody is found incompetent, and it says that if the person is what we call not restorable after two six-month periods, it says the charges shall be dismissed without prejudice. Without prejudice meaning the prosecutor is free to refile. But it also says if the defendant remains incompetent for 5 years, the same time period as Senator Klayman's bill, by the way, after the charges have been dismissed, the defendant may not be charged again for that same facts, except if the original charge is an A felony or an unclassified felony. So I think that's very clear. For the more serious crimes, you can do it at any point, but after 5 years, the 1141 crimes that are B or C felonies or below could be recharged because the case was dismissed without prejudice.
Thank you, Senator Tobin.
So I apologize if this comes off clumsy, but I know in the legislation, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it disallows a medical professional from declaring competency and within that five-year period. And one of the things I'm thinking of is if a medical professional is able to say you are competent, you need to be held accountable for your crime, but the individual hasn't applied for that declaration, as I think the legislation indicates that it must be petitioned by the patient or the individual who's committed a crime. I'm fearful someone might game the system is what I'm trying to decide or trying to figure out or flesh that part out.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin,
I may be reading it wrong.
Well, and so we may need to talk more after the hearing. I'm concerned that you're confusing a competency decision under Title 12, which really is not the bill really doesn't address competency, and I think the bill is talking about involuntary commitment, which is based on a finding of as a result of mental health or defective danger to themselves or others, and so I'm not sure. My general understanding on the competency side of the equation is that whether or not a person is competent is ultimately a decision for the court to make, that a medical professional can opine that this person is competent and can proceed to trial, but ultimately that person would testify to the court. I mean, the defendant's lawyer might say, we're not going to claim incompetence anymore, but ultimately that's a court decision on competence or not, or competence or incompetence. That's not the physician alone or the evaluator alone doesn't make that decision. And what we're trying to create in the statute with regard to involuntary commitment under Title 47 is that for people who are dangerous, that the medical professional may deem them no longer a danger to the community, but before they could be released to the community based solely on the medical professional's evaluation, you would need to have a court hearing for the individuals that meet this dangerousness test. There would have to be a court hearing, and the court would have to make a finding about that non-dangerousness before they could be released.
I just want to make sure the person is held accountable. So however that, I hear 5 years, I just want to make sure that if that is the period of time where an individual could be held with non-jeopardy or with jeopardy, ensuring that when in fact they are competent, they are held accountable.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I think there's different pieces. I think Ms. Yeah. Mead talked about that. Somebody that was not deemed competent, not charged with a Class A or an unclassified felony, that person, after 5 years of an involuntary hold, if still not competent, at that point couldn't be charged if 4 years and 6 months into the involuntary hold they were released and evaluated and found competent, then they would be able to bring criminal charges against that person.
I guess I have a myriad of questions.
I just want to note that Angela flew down yesterday and she's flying back tonight. I don't want the committee to lose the opportunity to hear from her. I'm pretty easy to find.
No, that's fine. Yeah, we can, just on that same topic in terms of time accrual on that. So if the crime was less time than the civil commitment, so let's say the crime was a 3-year max sentence, and then they're being committed for 5 years, how is that justified in terms of technically they're, I don't want to say being in prison, but they're being held for longer than the actual crime that they were being prosecuted under?
Mr. Chair, they are different. There is no criminal sanction. A person is incompetent, and so that the criminal proceedings are dismissed, and they are being held involuntarily based on their psychiatric condition that they are a danger to themselves or others, and that's a decision that, without being charged with a crime, a person who is found to be a danger to themselves or others, we could, and we have people today, I think not many, but they are being held for serial 380-day holds in the Alaska Psychiatric Institute based on a finding of danger to the community, and that. Now, oftentimes that may manifest itself with criminal conduct, and oftentimes that may not be charged, but the ability to hold somebody is unrelated to the criminal process because the incompetency means that they don't understand that process.
Thank you. Well, this time, let's go ahead and hear from our invited testifier. We'll go ahead and start our inviting public testing.
For the record, my name is Angela Harris. I was stabbed while returning borrowed items at the Lusac Library on Sunday afternoon, February 13, 2022. My family and I have lived in Alaska since 2005. I am a mother to 4 children, all of whom I've regularly taken to the library since they were young. I have 2 daughters serving in the United States Navy, one who promoted me to grandma a month ago, and a senior and a junior. I'm serving on active duty Coast Guard, and my assailant, Corey Lee Fakovac, drove a dirty Leatherman knife into my spine, between L2 and 3, penetrating my spinal cord. Mr. Akovec was located and arrested by APD later that afternoon while I was awaiting emergency surgery to remove the knife and the blood clots that damaged a nerve bundle in my spinal cord. The stabbing left me paralyzed from the waist down and with decreased sensation in my upper extremities. I was unable to live in my home until we made modifications in our house to become handicap accessible and safe for me to navigate. My parents flew in from the lower 48 to live in our home with my two youngest children for 8 months. I'm now on a long road to recovery, and I attended physical therapy and occupational therapy 5 days a week for approximately 9 months, and I see a counselor no less than twice a week to help work through the PTSD of my assault. After the assault, I was unable to see or hug any of my family members due to a COVID protocol. I was left to deal with the physical, mental, and emotional impact on my own. To have one designated approved visitor after I was transferred to St. Elias Rehabilitation Center, we had to petition committee members to request access. After many declines and being subpoenaed by the grand jury, I requested to be discharged against the doctor's orders because I could no longer navigate the tragedy on my own. Eventually, the committee agreed to approve one visitor. The designated member was permitted to enter and exit the building only once a day. Take a moment to imagine sitting alone, left to process the absolute worst event in your life. Sepsis still loomed as the knife was unclean, and your parents and your children could only see you from a window. Worse than this, imagine that it's you on the other side of the window looking at your loved one, wounded by a man who has been arrested on multiple occasions and released back into our community because the law has no provisions for him. Mr. Akovec has a history of assaulting women. In 2018, he violently attacked his mother with a frying pan. He attacked two other women on December 10th, 2021. He was declared incompetent and not restorable, and he was released back to the public on January 6th, 2022. On February 10th, 2022, he was arrested for trespassing. 38 days after his release, he stabbed me on February 13th, 2022. He was declared incompetent, and he could be released back into the public after his next competency hearing in a few months. There's no longer a record of these assaults, and the courts have been very unclear on whether or not they maintain information on those cases that are dropped due to incompetence. Furthermore, I no longer have the right to know when he is released because I'm told it violates his HIPAA rights. We need improvements to the state's mental health system, particularly regarding violent offenders, and we need to close the loophole in current laws that allow people to commit violent crimes only to be released back into our community. We need to give victims more peace. As I work towards healing, it's difficult for me to live with the reality that my assailant could be released after the next 180-day hearing. I attended several block hearings. Hearings where numerous cases are grouped and heard in one after another when the issues are very similar, and I was appalled at how often the defense was able to get their clients released from custody simply because there's a wait list for restitution and it was too long and it began to encroach upon the defendant's rights. I'm a firm believer that everything happens for a reason, and I know that Jesus would not have put me in this position if I couldn't handle it. With that being said, I intend to share my story while I continue to attend physical and occupational therapy appointments to physically heal with the hopes of reducing the amount of senseless violent assaults. Aaron, who was the main provider of our home, was unable to work as he had to care for me to take me to and from my daily outpatient care appointments. The state offers no financial assistance to supplement his lost income, and because he was not considered a victim, he was not offered support for the trauma that he experienced by watching his partner of 12 years lay on the floor with a knife in her back. There's no reimbursement for items needed to assist victims in daily living. Victims for Justice has a $40,000 cap on services provided. I would have blown through that the first hour after my attack. If I were not on active duty with the United States Coast Guard at the time of my attack, I would have very limited resources and cannot imagine the ruins of other victims and what they've experienced. As the perpetrator, Mr. Akovec has more rights, options, and resources at his disposal than I do as his victim. My attack is an example of why we need to be tougher in our laws and build out mental health facilities to get violent offenders the help that they need to properly prosecute them once they're restored. API serves our entire state, yet they're operating on a very limited capacity with a maximum of 80 beds, and only 10 of those are designated for restoration. If the state of Alaska has a robust mental health trust, where are the funds being allocated, if not API? We must address the common element of inadequate mental health services for violent offenders and their victims. I just share with you my experience and navigation through this process. I share this with you and all fellow Alaskans to emphasize that we must close the loopholes that allow violent offenders to victimize more innocent Alaskans. It's currently up to the victims to pursue a civil commitment if their assailant is being released due to incompetence. Why hasn't the state taken on this responsibility? Not every victim has resources to heal themselves, much less pursue a civil commitment request against their assailant. I have listened in on the block hearings, and I've heard victims plead with the courts to keep their attacker from being released, only to hear that they couldn't hold them because it exceeds a reasonable amount of time for them to get evaluated or treated. The moment an offender commits a criminal act against a fellow citizen, then their right of privacy should be outweighed by the victim's and the public's right to know, because this is a public safety issue. SB 53, presented here today by Senator Klayman, is an opportunity for you and your elected positions to make changes that are beneficial for all Alaskans, whether victim or offender. Senate Bill 53 is a good starting point, but I encourage each of you to learn more about the issues and find solutions to prevent what happened to me from happening to others. Without your support, my story will become normal for far too many Alaskans. My final question to all of you, is my sequence of events going to be the new normal, or do you have the internal fortitude to support and pass this bill so there are less Alaskans presenting with the same scenario as I've lived? Thank you for your attention and your time.
Thank you, Ms. Harris. I just want to
want to echo that. Thank you for being here and for having the strength to do this and for all you've endured. Thank you very much.
Well, with that, we do have a few moments for public testimony. I know that there is someone here in the room in Juneau wish to testify, so that's okay, Senator Klayman. Let's just go ahead and open public testimony.
I take a short pause while we move from the desk.
Grief at ease. We are back on the record. We're now going to open public testimony for Senate Bill 53. We have Ms. Mary Reagan in the room. Oh, okay, Mark. Yeah, sorry. It says Mary here.
That's my handwriting. Sorry, sir.
Been corrected, Mark. Yes, sorry about that. Plan about 2 minutes for your testimony.
Senator Wilson, members of the committee, my name is Mark Regan. I work for the Disability Law Center. I'm here to testify against Senate Bill 53, but also to apologize on behalf of the system for what happened to Ms. Harris. If state officials had had capacity at places like API, if they had been able to file a civil commitment petition after the most recent time this gentleman was found incompetent to proceed, then he would not have been out and the tragedy would not have happened. So it's not precisely that there are loopholes in the system. It is that the system is set up the wrong way in order to deal with problems like this. I want to talk about a particular part of how the system is set up in the next minute or so. The idea of competency restoration is that it is something that in practice happens at API. That's not the right place for this to happen. It participates in the overload at API. As Ms. Harris said, there are 80 beds at API, 10 are devoted to competency restoration. Another way to describe what she presented to you is that there are long waiting lists of people who are in jail, who have been found incompetent, and who don't have a place to go through competency restoration because it shouldn't take place in jail. It can't take place at API because those 10 beds are full. And if that is a problem which ought to be taken care of through a revision of the competency restoration system. We need that to happen at a different place than API. We need more beds to be available for that to happen. And that is something which might come out of this that would be a positive step if there is a way to do competency restoration that allows for more people to get the treatment that they need. The solution is not to impose a up to five years mandatory civil commitment on somebody. The solution would have been for the state to file a petition for civil commitment. The system didn't work right. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here in the room in Anchorage that wants to testify on Senate Bill 53? All right. Seeing none, and it looks like we lost Catherine Polanski. Catherine, if you're listening, feel free to submit your comments in writing to the Senate HES Committee at shss.akleg.gov. We would like to hear your comments, and sorry that you had to drop off the call. If Senator Clayman would like to come back up, schedule this bill hearing again, but I just want to get my questions on the record, and we can have a conversation about some of the issues that were brought up. I had the questions on the sort of the wait list and evals. My understanding is that just working with corrections over the past few years, a lot of folks are using sort of the incompetency hearings, because if it's a lesser charge of a misdemeanor, not quite felonies, then this is the easier way to get those charges dropped, just because of the time constraints and limitations on the Department of Law. So just wondering if we know how many evals are currently on the wait list now, and how, if there's any, I didn't see this in the notes either, in terms of if we need to bring more people on board to be able to handle sort of the evaluations and the qualifications on who's going to be handling this, where it's going to be done, and that you don't have to answer these things now. I just want to get them on the record here. And then similar to a comment that Ms. Harris had, I had a similar question on, I didn't see any here sort of similar to VineLink. Would there be no similar to VineLink? VineLink, it's the notification system.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That notices criminals when they get released. Can we add that to a release to people to notify their victims if they are go down this route. There is not the criminal prosecution, but they are then held in civil commitment. What can we do to help that notification? Because I don't really see it as a HIPAA violation. Maybe we can get a clarification on that. If we're just notifying someone when they're released, when I notify them, if they're, you know, their condition, their diagnosis is, or any medical, we're just notifying them that they are now released from being civilly committed. I mean, they know that they've been civilly committed, so yes.
So just a couple of answers, and if I don't answer all the questions, you can remind me. As to the number that are in restoration holds today, we'll get that information. We don't know. I do have information on the people that have been in sequential long-term commitments on civil commitments as of current statistics, and so I do have that if you'd like to know that today. In terms of the notice requirements and what options may exist for notice requirements, that's something that we're looking at and certainly supportive of seeing if there's a way to do that A, doesn't run afoul of HIPAA, but at some level we have to recognize that it's not a criminal case anymore. The civil commitment is a civil commitment, and so you really couldn't, it seems to me you couldn't integrate that into the criminal system, but that doesn't mean there may not be notice requirements that you could put in place, because there's, at least my very rough look at it would be that HIPAA protects certain privacy rights, but a civil commitment proceeding, I don't believe, is a confidential proceeding. Like a juvenile proceeding is confidential, but an adult civil commitment proceeding, I don't believe, is a confidential proceeding. I may be wrong about that too. But that's one of the questions I have you are looking into. All
right. Well, thank you. This is a...
And do you want the statistics on the people that are in presently?
People that are presently, and maybe we can get some information from the criminal side as well, because it seems like they'll be using the same similar resources as for the civil and the criminal side will be using very similar systems.
So the information you received from the Department of Family and Community... Family and Community Services, yes, Family and Community Services. There are 10 individuals that are currently, that would be viewed as in long-term civil commitments. One patient has been in long-term commitment since 2015. A second has been in long-term commitment since 2017, but is currently in an outpatient commitment that began in 2023, just this January 2023. One patient that has been in civil commitment since May 2019, one patient since February 2020, one patient since February 2021, one patient from July 2021, one patient from December 2022, one from March 2022, one from September 2022, and the 10th started a long-term commitment in August 31st of 2022, but that person actually began outpatient commitment in December 2022. That would suggest that perhaps they may still be in state custody, but it doesn't sound like as long a commitment as some of the others. But they gave me a list of 10 people that were all identified by letters and not names.
Well, we are out of time for today. We'll set Senate Bill 53 aside, make sure we close public testimony. And we'll bring this bill back up from committee so we schedule with a sponsor and try to get some more answers and work some things out. Thank you, Senator Klayman, and thank you, Ms. Harris, for being here again. Are there any closing comments from committee members? Seeing none, on Thursday, we'll consider a CS for Senate Bill 45, Direct Healthcare Agreements, and hear and take an introduction and invite in public testimony on Senate Bill 44, Naturopaths, Licensees, and Practices, which is sponsored by Senator Gietzel by request. And we are adjourned at 5:01 p.m.